everyone. This is Maria Valdez with What's Up Public Health, sharing with you the latest public health news, topics, and discussion. Today, we have Ana Carolina Ortiz with us. She is the Global Health and Development Director at Esperanza, a Peace Corps Panama alumni, founder and chair of the Arizona Global Development Network, Regional Director for Latin American for the International Association of Community Development, and former Sustainable Development and Health Equity Consultant for the Pan American Health Organization. So a lot of good global health experience, a lot of experience. Thank you so much for being with us today. Today we'll be having a conversation with her on the inequity seen in not just the US, but even in other countries, a global perspective, and comparing and contrasting the differences we see between all of those social determinants of health and more. So stay tuned. Ana, thank you so much for joining us today and taking your time. You're pretty busy gal, so thank you for squishing it in your schedule and being able to give us a little talk of global health and the social determinants of health and sort of how everything connects. So we have a couple of stories here that you sent me over that I thought we could go over, you know, talk a little bit about and see how those stories connect with public health. I think a lot of the times people who aren't in public health, when they hear a story, they don't catch the public health in it. Unlike us that we're in public health, right? We're always looking at the social determinants of health, policy, all of this. So do you wanna go over the first story and sort of what the story in general is? Maybe just paint a picture for the audience and then we'll get into the nitty gritty.
Yes, of course. And first of all, I'd like to thank you, Maria, for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here and share with your audience a little bit about the work that we do and the perspective I've gained on global health and how it intersects with the social determinants of health. So in 2019, I met Julian and his family, his wife and his four kids. And they live in a pretty rural community. And I met him because his family was part of a program that we were partnering on. And the goal of the program was to provide housing that improved climate adaptation and quality of life for the people living in that community. So the thing is, before Esperanza partnered with this community, the homes were making families sick. Children and women were suffering from acute respiratory infections. The area where they live is extremely cold, and oftentimes the water is freezing. So it is difficult for children to bathe or to want to bathe, period. So hygiene practices were very poor, leading to children not showering frequently enough and you know, leading to other infections. Sometimes even cooking with dirty water because of the freezing water. So it's just, you know, kind of compounding issues due to the remoteness, due to climate change and instability of weather patterns, and just having homes that weren't adequate for the living conditions anymore. So at that point, Esperanza kind of came into the picture with other partner organizations. And after being invited to participate in this community, we partnered with the community members to design homes that were safe, comfortable, and culturally appropriate for that community. So, you know, our main goal was to design it in a way that, you know, mothers didn't have to suffer from acute respiratory infections just because they wanted to cook a meal for the family, or so that children could, you know, bathe more frequently and not be afraid of the shower, which is can sound a little crazy, but truly the water is so cold that you'd rather just not shower, not touch the water. So yeah, that's a little bit about my first story, and I wanted to share a little quote from Julian. The man that I met in 2019, he said, before we lived very sad in a single environment altogether, in a home where the cold would come in. And now we are very happy because we have a house that is warm and the children are warm and have a safe house. So, you know, maybe it's not the first thing that comes to mind when we think about health, but our homes do play a big role in our daily health outcomes.
It's pretty incredible when you're saying the story, because I don't think that many of us exactly see how that connects with our health, because I think we don't realize at times the privilege it is to have a roof, not only a roof, but to have warm water, to have a stove that works, to have a refrigerator. It may seem like something that, oh, everybody has, but it's something that many people actually don't have. So it's a very touching story. And Esperanza, thank you to your organization for all the help that they give these families now. Now, going a little bit to the social determinants of health. So housing is one of them, right? So if you could just give the audience a little bit of education on what the social determinants of health is. I think right now there is a fad in medicine, not so much in public health, because as we know, in public health, it's public health, and then it's medicine, and then, you know, healthcare is made up of public health and medicine and all of that. But in medicine, there's a fad right now where social determinants of health is like everything people want to focus on, especially after COVID. But many of the times, actually, many people don't know what the social determinants of health are, or they Google it and they're like, oh, it's this listings of things. But one thing is to memorize the list. Another thing is to know how to use that list. So why don't you give us a little education? What are the social determinants of health? And could you sort of connect it with the story to show what social determinants of health Julian and their family were dealing with?
So the social determinants of health are kind of the factors outside of traditional clinical medicine that affect our health outcomes. That's still pretty jargony and pretty public healthy, so I'm going to break it down a little bit more. So there are the conditions in which people are born, in which people grow, in which people work, live, play, and the forces outside of that that affect our daily lives. Some of these forces and systems that affect us are political systems, our social policies, they can be our education, access to education, it can be transportation, it can be your neighborhood and how safe it is. I know some things that are common, at least here in the Phoenix area, for example. You know, if you live in a community that's close to the train tracks or close to the airport, and you have poor air quality, and you don't have reliable transportation, and you don't have safe community, you can't just go out for a walk around your community because the sidewalks are poor or because there are no sidewalks, then what kind of quality of life can you expect if you have all these barriers? And the thing with these social determinants of health is they compound on top of each other. So you already don't have, you know, reliable transportation. On top of that, there's not really good sidewalks, so you can't walk anywhere. And then if you do decide to walk somewhere, the air in your community is polluted because you live by the airport. And then they just kind of add to each other. And so in this story with Julian, what we see is, first of all, climate change is kind of, you know, it's a big daunting
big one.
Yeah, it's a really big one that can sometimes feel like it's out of our control. But, you know, what we came to learn with this family is that there are things that you can do to adapt, be more resilient in the face of climate change, because, you know, it is so huge and at times outside of our control. Another thing that we came across in this community is gender. Gender is a social determinant of health because, you know, the conditions in the home, and especially in the kitchen, were such that the people that were in the home most often were the ones that were being affected. And who's that typically? That's the women, the mothers. You know, they work in the home. They don't leave the home to do their work. So they were the ones that were getting the worst health outcomes. I'm not saying that the rest of the family wasn't, but you could see a disparity, a difference in the health between the people that were more often in the home than ones that were not. Another social determinant of health, I mean, the obvious one is housing that we already mentioned. You know, having a safe, healthy home can look different in different places. And in this community, because it's so remote, because it's so rural, and because it's so cold, having a warm house is a big deal. In Arizona, I mean, here, it might be a little different. If, you know, if you're talking about Southern Arizona versus Northern Arizona, we have different conditions to a safe house. And in this particular case with Julian and their community, a safe house was having a warm house.
I think it's interesting that you mentioned gender as a social determinant of health. And the reason I say that is because this is where the social determinants of health gets hard. And I think this is where people start getting mixed up between social determinants of health and risk factors. So there's a huge theory out there, and it's been a theory that researchers, scientists, public health physicians have sort of fought over is, okay, so would you say that, and I want to ask you to see sort of what you think, would you say then that gender and race is a risk factor for certain diseases?
I think you can look at it from two different perspectives. If we're talking about clinical medicine, because there is research saying that minorities, either racial minorities or gender minorities, are treated differently in clinical settings. So I do think that that's a risk factor in clinical settings, because you already know you're getting a different experience from the rest of the population. But when we're talking about non-clinical medicine, I do think it's still a social determinant of health, because it can impact. For example, if you're a single mom with young children, are you going to be able to rent an apartment by yourself in an area that's safe? Are people going to want to rent to you? Yes or no? It's hard to say. That might be a social determinant of health and whether you're able to find safe housing or not. So yeah. I'd like to say that it depends. I hate saying that because it's kind of
that's an answer to a lot of things.
It's kind of a non-answer, but I think it would apply in both cases. I think it just depends on whether you're talking about a clinical setting or not.
I think you mentioned it earlier that research has seen it, and research has shown it that Hispanics, for example, we're the ones, and I say we because I'm Hispanic, we're the ones that have the highest rate of heart disease, of chronic disease. But I think that our race and our gender is not so much a physiological risk factor like genetics, where if I have the BRAF gene, that's a risk factor for me to get breast cancer. I think rather so, it is more of the thing of this race is going to increase your risk of a disease, not because of physiological factors, but because that race has more social determinants of health involved, which brings us back to what research has shown is that, and this is why this topic is very important to get nitty gritty with, is that the social determinants of health actually affects 80% of our health. And I think many people think, oh, they're Hispanic, they're Black, that's why they're Native American, that's why they're going to get heart disease because their hearts work less than, and no, it's not that my heart works less than an American or a Caucasian or another type of race. It's just that when I was little, I lived in Yuma, Arizona, like myself, for example, I lived in Yuma, Arizona, where when I was little, there was only one cardiologist. So I don't know if I wanted to see a cardiologist for my dad. It was months on end. So I think, yes, you can say that, like you mentioned, it's a risk factor, but not physiologically, but because we have so much social determinants of health just compounded. So I think a lot of people have that struggling with, okay, is this a risk factor? Is it not? There's a theory out there, but this is where I think the social determinants of health gets a little tricky. And some people don't realize it, how tricky it can actually get if you're really trying to unravel things. So housing. So housing seemed to be, with this family, seemed to be the biggest social determinants of health that was affecting them negatively. How is housing directly connected to health or indirectly connected to health?
I mean, I think it was fairly obvious in this story, in terms of, you know, because of the conditions in which they live, like I said, remote, rural, very cold, having a home that was warm, that was safe, that could keep them safe from the elements, because they are so vulnerable to climate change. That is one of the obvious ones. But even if we take it outside of that example, you think about people experiencing homelessness and what housing means to them. And there have been, even here in Phoenix, there have been several very successful programs that have given housing to people experiencing homelessness. And with that, they see a huge improvement in, I mean, obviously their quality of life, but also in their health, which is, you know, a direct correlation to them having housing. So I think even with that, we're able to see the importance of having safe, reliable housing for all, because it's a safe place to go. It can keep you safe from the elements. I think emotionally too, and mental health wise, it's a big stressor not to have adequate housing. So I think with those two examples, we get a pretty clear idea of how housing is tied to health.
Yeah, and exactly, emotionally it is, because for example, myself, when I'm out and about with work or out all day for something else, I mean, even when we go to vacation, we always say, okay, this was enough in the beach. I just want to get home to my room, to my dog, to whatever. And it's emotionally, it's a feeling that's very strong, right? And it just, imagine not being able, where do you go? You have no place, you have no belonging. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, sort of brings me to the other question I had, was shelters. For homeless people, you have shelters, you have this, you have programs out there. And I think it happens a lot when people hear, oh, that person's homeless. And I will say it, because it's happened to me in my close environment too, that when people are homeless, they will say, oh, well, why don't they just work? Or oh, why don't they just go to that shelter in the corner? I see they're always taking people. Oh, why don't they do this, this, and that, and all of these other things? Well, as we know, being in public health, a lot of shelters have no funding. A lot of shelters kick you out. You go in at night and by 8 a.m. you have to be out. So imagine in Arizona, where it's hot, where it's 120, 115, the most crucial time you'd like to be inside a place, you have to be outside. So, but even removing the housing, like directly just the housing, sometimes Section 8, we have Section 8, it's a program in not only Arizona, but in a federal program in the US is Section 8. And I, being in the community health field sector before, and you've probably witnessed this yourself, some of those conditions of those housings are bad. They're bad, they have no working AC, or they have no working heater. The door doesn't work, so they can't close the door fully. And they obviously have Section 8 because they're low income, so they don't have the money or the means to pay for, to fix the AC. And the government in itself, the state government or federal government, also has no money because we have really bad funding in housing. And they're sort of like, this is all you get, this is all we can give. With that being said, housing is not just the roof. It's also the AC, it's also the working refrigerator. It's also all of these other factors that play in. But I wanted to sort of see your perspective. Is the government's duty? Do you, in your experience, let's say a family has housing, like I said, but no AC or no heater, and they live in Chicago or something, should the state and federal government take charge and make sure families have not only housing, but also all of those other items for sustainable and dignified housing?
It's a really great question, and I think pretty loaded question for yes. The United States, unfortunately, because if we're talking in general in the world, then yes, I definitely agree that the government should have a strong role in providing safe housing to all. However, I'm also a realistic person and saying that living in the United States, I know that that's not very realistic just because given our political system, you know, it's seen as a really big social program, and to get something of that magnitude funded by our government, I think would be an enormous feat. That's not to say it's impossible. I think that we already have a lot of groups and organizations fighting towards that, and we've made strides, but we're very far from reaching what we need to reach. And I think that's where we see, you know, nonprofits are usually the ones to come in and fill those gaps. That's honestly, that's why I have a job, because the government doesn't always do its job. So, you know, it's kind of a difficult thing to answer, because coming from the nonprofit standpoint, you know, our job is to technically put ourselves out of a job, to fix all the social issues so we no longer are needed. And that's, you know, that's all great and fine. But when we live in a country like the United States, and we know that the possibility of a social program such as dignified housing for all is so far out of reach, then it really does fall on us. And I mean, us, the nonprofit sector, to put those programs forth. And hopefully, you know, by proving that they are possible and profitable, then leveraging government funding to do that. I know that there are several nonprofit organizations in the Valley that have done that very successfully, and I applaud them for their work, because they have shown that the model works, that it is profitable, and that they can engage the government in subsidizing that. So I think sometimes the government needs a little push and shove from our end to see that it is something that is worth investing in. So sometimes we can't wait for it to come from the top. We have to work from grassroots and get them involved that way, because otherwise if you just sit here waiting for them, it might not happen. So, it is already, like I said, there are already activities and actions towards that, which give me a lot of hope. So I do think that it's the government plays a big role in it. I don't think that they can do it by themselves, though.
I think one of the things that the government does not see is the profitability at times. The profitability of what I think a lot of the times housing is seen as by political leaders, both state and at a federal level, both in DC and both in our own states, is that, wow, we need to invest so much money to create this housing. And they think, you know what, let's grab all that money and put it into the healthcare system, which I've personally even heard a lot of policymakers and legislators at both levels go through that route. And I think this is where they have the good intention and think, you know what, let's put it into health. Let's invest more in our health system and get them healthy so they can get a house and they can get a job and this and that and blah, blah. But I think this is where, like you mentioned, not only do the nonprofits come in, but the public health professionals and experts come in to say, especially in the US, looking particularly in the US, we're already investing all of this money in our healthcare system. Our GDP And I wish we had an economist here, then we can go talk about this all day.
Right, yeah.
It'd be amazing. One day we'll have to bring one in and relive this topic. But we spend so much of our GDP in the healthcare system, but yet our longevity in age of life in the US is lower than other countries that spend less. And I think a lot of that comes back to the social determinants of health, is that if we fix housing to a certain extent, we will be contributing to health indirectly. And I don't think a lot of policymakers, obviously, if they're not in public health, they won't realize that connection of how, and the thing is also, economically speaking, it's a very delayed gratification. Yeah. You're not gonna see this growth or this impact in the healthcare economic system till later on, when you realize infection rates have decreased, because that's one of the top reasons why people are in hospitals is due to infections. And a lot of those infections, where do they come from? They come from the home. A lot of movement is happening, like you said, but politicians and policymakers need to realize that social determinants of health, if those are worked on, we will see an improvement in quality of life and health in people in the US in general, especially rural and small communities. And at the same time, we may even economically see a better outcome by spending less GDP or less money on our healthcare system and putting it towards money for nonprofits so they can create programs, so their grants won't go away in 2 years. So we can invest in more of that growth at a community level instead of at a state level where barely money is giving to housing. I think HUD is one of those in the federal system that's like, oh yeah, HUD's there. It exists. Good to know. Sort of.
You bring up a really great point, Maria. And if I could make a quick pitch, I do get to work with a lot of students through our internship program. And I'm always encouraging, if not trying to convince them to get involved in policy and politics as well, because we need public health people everywhere, because public health isn't everything. Health is connected to everything we do. And that's the cool slash really challenging thing about public health, is that when it's working, it's invisible. And because it's working well, and when it's not, it can be a really big issue, you know, kind of like COVID. So my call to all young public healthers out there is to not be scared, not be intimidated of getting involved in policy and politics, because we need well-rounded representation at all levels of government to know these critical facts of, you know, health isn't everything. So if we invest in this one area, it will impact health eventually.
And you mentioned that phrase that public health is everywhere and anywhere where we live, in a very particular week, because it's National Public Health Week. And that's really the topic, actually, is that public health is everywhere. Public health is where you live. Public health is me sitting right here. It's the access I have and the privilege even that I have. And I agree, to any youngster, or not even anybody who just simply wants to have that involvement in policy, we definitely need it. And I think we need a lot of the representation of nuestra gente, of us, of Hispanics, Blacks, other people of color, Native Americans. We need that representation because we need people that have seen and have lived and not only studied it, but seen and lived it, to come and be like, look, this is what goes on. Maybe you don't know it because you grew up in a different environment in the suburbs and so on, but this does happen in the background, even though nobody goes to those remote places. So we do need so many more diversity and so much more people in public health. But going on to sort of our next story, because I can speak about public health and the economy and the healthcare GDP and all of that forever. But the second story, so why don't you give us a little bit similar to the other story, sort of a picture of that story and what it is.
Thank you everyone for tuning in on our podcast today to hear us talk with Anna on the social determinants of health at a global scale. Stay tuned with us to hear the second story that she has for us today and to see how that story is impacted by the social determinants of health. And at the end, to connect both stories, because both stories are actually not from the same country, despite the similarities we'll hear later on today. So stay tuned to hear that second part. Thank you.